Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Boughton, The Life of a Baseball Original, by Mitchell Nathanson, narrated by Barry Abrams. With rebellion, awareness is born. Albert Camus. Prologue. Publication Day. The banging on the door was not going to stop. That was clear enough from both its frequency and its force. Norm Miller sat naked on the bed as the cacophony engulfed him. On one side of the room, the persistent ringing of the telephone. On the other, the banging of the door. His roommate was taking care of the telephone, for the moment at least, engaging the reporter on the other end of the line. Miller had lost count by now of the number of calls his roommate had received already. As soon as he nestled the receiver into its cradle, off it would go again within seconds. Never before had the arrival of the perennial sad sack Houston Astros to New York generated this much attention, but never before had anybody on the club or in the game of baseball drawn attention to themselves or the game in the way Jim Boughton just had. Boughton tried his best to talk over the pounding on the door, but the louder he spoke, the more persistent it became. Finally, he pleadingly eyed Miller, and Miller realized that he had no choice but to answer the door. He rose from the bed and, in his full glory, opened it to behold a scowling Howard Cosell, swathed in his rumpled trench coat and fedora. No matter what the weather, no matter what the circumstance, Cosell always looked as if he were in an early stage of melt. The morning's glorious late spring sunshine had no bearing on his visage in the least. Cosell looked right through Miller and lasered in on his target. Not waiting for an invitation from the naked utility outfielder, Cosell brushed by him and headed straight for the phone, grabbing it out of Boughton's hand. He sneered his nasal twang into the mouthpiece, cutting off in his staccato cadence the voice on the other end of the line in mid-sentence, "This interview is terminated," and slammed the receiver down. Now, for the moment at least, there was silence. No ringing of the phone, no knocking on the door. Miller returned to his bed and considered pulling up the covers. Instead, he slowly stretched out to listen. No matter, he could have lit himself on fire, and Cosell would not have looked away from Boughton. Because Cosell was where every sports writer, sportscaster, and baseball fan wanted to be, standing face to face with the man who had just blown up the national pastime. The June 2, 1970 edition of Look magazine had hit the stands just hours earlier, and in it was a 10-page excerpt of Ball 4. In those 10 pages, a century of baseball mythology was set aflame and vaporized. Therein, readers were assaulted with tales of greenies, carousing, beaver shooting, and players making out, with stewardesses, groupies, and, after a few drinks, each other. But most scandalous of all was a portrayal of baseball's golden boy, Mickey Mantle, drunkenly staggering into the batter's box and somehow hitting a home run. What's more, another bomb was promised in the next issue, 2 weeks hence. The book hadn't even reached bookstores yet, and already everybody wanted to speak with the journeyman pitcher who had written it. Much of America was, by 1970, coming apart at the seams. Only baseball seemed stitched tightly enough to resist the forces of change, wound as it was deep into its mythic past. Or so it had appeared. When the June 2nd edition of Look hit the stands, myth became exposed as such, and baseball for the first time looked very much like the real world in which it was played. Cosell might have been oblivious to a lot of what was happening in Miller and Boughton's Roosevelt Hotel room that Friday morning, but he was keenly aware of one thing, that he was bearing witness to the dawn of a new era. Baseball had spent more than a century building itself up as something otherworldly. With the release of Ball 4, Jim Boughton brought it down to earth. Cosell, who liked to brag that only he could tell it like it is, was at last staring down a man who really did. If it appeared odd that it was a Major League Baseball player, of all people, who had unmasked the cloistered world of the professional athlete, it made perfect sense that Jim Boughton would be the MLB player to do it. Already, at age 31, it was a role he seemed destined to play his entire life. Part 1. The Bulldog. 1. Warm-up Boughton. On the day Jim Boughton was born, Generalissimo Francisco Franco declared a total blockade of all Republican-controlled ports in Spain, threatening to torpedo any and all ships that entered what he now declared his waters. A day earlier, Mahatma Gandhi ended a 4-day fast over the issue of constitutional reform in Rajkot, and a day before that, back in the States, the United Automobile Workers amended its constitution to officially bar communists from its ranks. Jim Boughton may have been born into the weight of history when he arrived on March 8, 1939, but to his good fortune, he had likewise been born into a family that was hardly imprisoned by it. It could very well have been. The Boughtons can trace their roots back to 16th century France, where Nicholas Boughton was better known as Count Chamis, Baron Montague de Natone, and his son not only claimed a title himself, but a spot on the portrait wall in the Gallery of French Nobles at Versailles. More recently, Daniel Boughton was bayoneted by a British infantryman at the Battle of Bunker Hill in 1775, becoming the first, but certainly not the last, Boughton the establishment desired to see filleted. But it wasn't their history that defined the Boughtons. Instead, it was their desire to upend and redirect it. On both sides, Jim Boughton's lineage was dotted with tinkerers, with fiddlers, with people who saw things as they might be, rather than merely as they were. Both grandfathers were inventors of a sort. His maternal grandfather patented several variations on the pressure cooker. His company was later bought out by the pressure-frying behemoth Hobart, and his paternal grandfather obtained patents while at Westinghouse on an elevator system for efficiently ferrying fighter planes from the underdeck of aircraft carriers to the flight deck. If his family had one defining characteristic, his brother Bob recalled, it was in making it up, things and otherwise. Both families resided in prim, proper Park Ridge, Illinois. The Rodhams lived nearby. Hillary would not arrive until 1947, where Jim's parents met and eventually became a couple. They weren't yet married when Jim's mother Trudy became unexpectedly pregnant with him in 1938. Once word got around, the moral arbiters of the neighborhood made it clear that that would not do in Park Ridge. They were encouraged to seek residence elsewhere for the duration of the pregnancy. Left with little choice, Jim's parents withdrew from high school and went to live with a grandparent in the more socially tolerant New York City area. For Jim's father, George, a swimming, diving, and track star at Park Ridge's Maine Township High School, this meant the abandonment of his formal education. He turned down athletic scholarship offers from Duke and Brown as he headed east to look for work to support the new family he suddenly had responsibility for. After a time, the Boughtons settled in Rochelle Park, New Jersey, where during the war, George had spent time in the Navy. Without a college degree, his options were limited. Eventually, his father-in-law got him a job with his company selling pressure cookers. Soon, he began taking night classes in an effort to regain some of what he had lost earlier. "When I was real young," Jim recalled years later, "Dad sold pressure cookers in a department store all day, went to Columbia University at night, and still had time to do things like build an addition on the house." Jim's brother Pete recalled a man who rarely came home unrumpled. "He had his feet in both worlds, blue collar and white," he remembered. "He was smart and industrious, but lacking the credentials that would firmly place him in a position of safety from market forces. Whatever job he had, it was the one that they got rid of whenever times got tough," said Pete. Regardless, for much of Jim's youth, the Boughtons were a traditional one-income family. Trudy was a stay-at-home mother, tending to the expanding Rochelle Park house along with Jim and his brother Bob, who came along nearly 2 years later. She joined the neighborhood bridge club, organized get-togethers with neighbors, and lived a life on the proverbial mid-century suburban front porch. For a time, she was a gray lady volunteer at a local hospital. The Bowden boys, Jim, Bob, and a few years later baby brother Pete, were, like many boys of the era, on their own for most of the day. "Moms at the time," Pete recalled, "weren't too involved with boys. They'd get kicked out of the house in the morning and wouldn't come home until the streetlights came on. We'd be out playing all day long, and Mom would call us in for lunch or dinner, but that was about it. We'd do our own thing, go down to the playground or into town or wherever. She had no idea where the hell we were." Wherever they were rarely bored. Traversing the environs of Rochelle Park wasn't difficult. There wasn't much of Rochelle Park to traverse. Located in southwest Bergen County, it was, Jim remembered, more of a cartographic afterthought than anything. "On local maps, it appears as a dot west of Hackensack. On larger maps, it doesn't even have its own dot." All three Boughton boys shared a bedroom in their home on Central Avenue, one they couldn't wait to escape as soon as the sun rose. Because they were closer in age, Jim and Bob would often pal around together, stopping at Slupo's candy store for sugar daddies before heading over to the viaduct under Route 17, where they'd gird themselves for the rocks hurled at them by the hobos sleeping there if they arrived too early and startled them. Little Pete occasionally played the role of prop. Jim and Bob would send him up unsuspecting doorsteps and ring the bell, claiming he was a starving orphan. Although the ruse rarely worked, in a town of 7,000 nearly everybody knew everybody else, Pete would often walk away with a handful of cookies anyway, which he'd share with his brothers who were hiding in the bushes. One time their target called their bluff and invited Pete inside for a meal, leaving Jim and Bob to stew in the bushes. Eventually, they had to ring the doorbell to retrieve him. That was all they left with. Pete walked out full, but empty-handed. It wasn't long before pre-adolescent Jim was in business for himself. The feeling of independence that came from walking into Slupo's with purchasing power intoxicated him by the time he was 8. "I liked the fact that I had my own ability to feed myself. Any time there was something in the newspaper, sell chocolates door to door, whatever, okay, good, I'd send away for a kit. I liked having money in my pocket, and I liked having control over my life." He and Bob started a sports club and collected dues from the neighborhood kids, found old newspapers to sell to scrap dealers. They would store them in the garage until there was no room for George's car, at which point Bob would call the scrap dealer for the pickup, and gathered empty ice cream cups at George's fast-pitch softball games. If you collected 20 cups, you got a free ice cream from Joe Slush, who sold them out of the back of his truck at the games. Jim was always entrepreneurial, Pete recalled. He could see an opportunity and get right on it. He was great at figuring out what other people's needs were and filling them. By the fourth grade, he had business cards made up. "You name it, we'll do it," they read. Whenever someone named it, he and Bob did it. Mowing lawns, shoveling snow, whatever. Recognizing an opportunity shortly after the war, Jim started his own scrap metal business. "I'd be walking home from school, and I'd see a bolt or a fender, and I'd grab it, take it home with me, and store it in the woods part of my backyard. After a while, I had a tremendous pile." At that point, he'd flag down the man driving through the neighborhood looking for scrap metal himself. The man paid by the pound. "I think I got over $50, which is an enormous amount of money for a guy who's in third grade." When it came to sports, the Boughton boys had to make it up here as well. Rochelle Park was too small for organized youth leagues, so the summers and school year afternoons were dominated by pickup games of one sort or another. "Every day you went down to the park and you chose up sides," Jim remembered. Occasionally, they'd play stickball under the viaduct, stopping whenever a car passed through. He also played catch with George and Bob and learned very early how to throw a ball far and hard. Soon, he figured out how to make it curve. When he was 10, he turned to the back of a Wheaties box and saw a photo of old-time pitcher Dutch Leonard, along with a description of how to throw a knuckleball, a pitch that has baffled pitchers, catchers, and batters alike since it was introduced in the late 19th century. Batsmen who are accustomed to working against speedy pitchers find the floater very bothersome, wrote a perplexed Cleveland sports writer in 1908. The ball looms up to the plate as big as a Halloween pumpkin, and just as it arrives, seems to assume the proportions of a pea and fall to nothing at all. Leonard used two fingers, but my hands were too small, so I had to use three, Jim remembered. I started to throw them to my brother Bob, and finally I got one to break. He had his hands up here, by his chest, and it dropped and hit him on the kneecap. I spent the rest of that summer trying to break my brother's kneecaps. It was a difficult pitch to master, but he kept at it until he did. His knuckleball was so good, Bob remembered, that you could not follow it. It would dip, go up, down, sideways. Even he didn't know where it was going. It was dangerous. That Wheaties box would alter the course of his life. Not just that he saw it, but that he saw it when he did. The knuckleball is like the violin, in that it is better learned by children, he once said. A split finger you can pick up in an hour and a half. Gripping the ball behind the seams 7 decades later, he still had the ability to make it dance. If learned with a child's grip, you'll remember it the rest of your life. The pickup games may have been informal, but to Jim at least, they meant as much as any World Series game. I was a terrible kid, he said years later. I always had to win. I was a poor sport. None of the kids liked me. I was a bad loser. I'd sulk, kick, cry, and stomp. I was awful. Bob had a front-row seat for all of this throughout their years in Rochelle Park. He could not handle a situation where somebody made an error. If there was a pop fly and the second baseman dropped it, Jim would run towards him, berate him, and maybe even give him a little nudge or a kick. It was very important to him not to lose. Eventually, he had a difficult time finding teammates. Few 8-year-olds wanted to be reminded of their athletic shortcomings whenever a ball came their way. If they were looking to be on the winning side, however, there was nobody better. From the first pitch, he was intense and competitive. I'm here, and you're going to have a tough time, was his worldview, said Pete. You may beat me, but it ain't going to be easy. Let's go. I was a pretty good little ball player back then, Jim remembered. Very little. When he was 11, he played formal ball for the first time, having made his Midland Elementary School's 5th grade team. One problem, there were no uniforms small enough to fit him. Trudy had to stitch his herself. On the mound, in his homemade Midland Lions uniform, Jim realized that this is where he wanted to be, with the ball, in control, staring down a hitter. The dynamic was the purest distillation of his competitive fire, and as such, the biggest thrill of his life. Nothing would, nothing could, ever supplant it. George, himself a pitcher, for Jack's Tavern, would oftentimes bring Jim to his softball games. As the oldest and most athletically inclined, Jim seemed to be George's favorite, or at least that's how his brothers interpreted things. Before games, little Jim Boughton would be out there with the men, shagging flies during batting practice. He was usually the only kid out there. George, Jim remembered one of his father's teammates admonishing him when he first sent his son out with the guys. Your boy's there. He's in a lot of trouble. They're hitting line drives. He's going to get hurt. No, George replied. He's not going to have any problem at all. A few minutes later, there was a screaming line drive into short center field, and Jim ran, dove, and caught it. The teammate was impressed. I guess you're right, George. I guess he's okay. From the start, George not only had confidence in Jim, but was also eager to demonstrate that confidence publicly. This filtered down. I always felt like I could do anything. His competitiveness and confidence, combined with his short stature, put Jim on the side of the underdog early on. Aside from the reality that the smallest kid on the field had no choice but to prove himself each and every time, it was just more fun to be on that side than with the guys who expected to prevail. Whenever we chose up sides for something like basketball, if there were an odd number of guys, I always wanted to be on the side where it looked like it was an impossible situation. I loved the underdog role. I'd rather lose in that sort of situation than make it easy. It was the challenge of it all he loved the most, the fun of overcoming the odds, or not, but at least trying to. In this way, he was the epitome of blue-collar Rochelle Park. "Nobody rooted for the Yankees in Rochelle Park," Jim would say. "It didn't seem sporting, like shooting fish in a barrel." Yankee fans were the kids who wanted to be on the side with five guys rather than four, who only liked the bedtime stories with happy endings. Yankee fans, we believed, were the sons of bankers who lived in towns with bigger houses and nicer lawns. Roger Angel once described the Yankees as the rich family up on the hill. Rochelle Park was at the bottom of that hill, so Rochelle Park kids rooted for either the Giants or the Dodgers. When they could swing it, the brothers trekked over to the Polo Grounds to root on their team of choice, the New York Giants. They'd bring their lunches, tuna fish or peanut butter sandwiches that would befoul the air by the third inning on a warm day, and cheer on Willie Mays, Whitey Lockman, and the rest. Whenever possible, they'd arrive well before game time to try to catch the players as they were entering the stadium to ask for their autographs. This by itself was not unusual. There were dozens of kids there every time, but little Jim Bouton was no doubt the only one to make sure to reserve a space between the signatures of Mays and Amalfitano for his own autograph, which he would add after the game. "I wanted to see how I would sign when I was a big league player," he said later. Not if, when. By the time Jim was 13, George was doing a little better financially, so the Boutons packed up and headed for Ridgewood, New Jersey, home of the bankers with the bigger houses and nicer lawns. Monochrome, white-collar, comfortable Ridgewood, where the Yankee fans resided. Whatever rough edges Rochelle Park presented, Ridgewood smoothed away. Here would be where young Jim Bouton would finally have the space to get serious about school and plan for his future, or at least, that was the thought. Quickly, however, it became obvious to everyone that Jim was singularly focused. He wanted to be a baseball player. So it was Bob whose academic star rose as he became the designated engineer in the family, urged by his parents and relatives to carry on the Bouton tinkerer tradition. He would eventually graduate with an engineering degree from Cornell. "Bob was more of a student, got very good grades," Pete recalled. "Jim was a decent student, but his focus was baseball. He was good, but he didn't have the focus on grades that Bob did." Thus did Bob become the engineer in waiting, and Jim become the ball player. Summer mornings would arrive with Jim urging Bob to get out of bed already because there was a ball game somewhere and they needed to be a part of it. "Why are you just reading books?" Jim would ask Bob. "Why are you studying?" he wanted to know. "Why sit at home when there are games to be played?" "I was the student," Bob recalled, "and he was the athlete." More than simply participate, Jim had an overwhelming desire to run the entire enterprise, no matter what it might be. "He liked to be the showmaker," said Bob. "He wanted to call the shots." He had in his head a vision of what needed to be done to make whatever it was, to him at least, better and more fun, even though that might not have been something other people wanted to do, Bob remembered. No matter, Jim would push them forward, bending them toward his will, undaunted. This portrait of Bouton's childhood perhaps clashes with the future image of him among his professional teammates and many of the scribes as something of a thinker, a cleated philosopher, but only upon first glance. In truth, he was very much a thinker, albeit an untraditional one who was always open to acquiring knowledge from unconventional sources, people, circumstances, the streets, rather than simply textbooks. He was every bit the tinkerer as anyone else in the Boughton household, although his smarts didn't evidence themselves on his quarterly report cards. He was simply interested in things that weren't tested in school. To the surprise of many, today, but not then, he was never much of a reader. About all he read with any regularity were the sanitized Chip Hilton books written by former basketball coach Claire B. Starting with the football-themed Touchdown Pass in 1948, these sports-themed novels for boys presented wholesome life lessons through baseball, football, and basketball that were little different from the ones sports writers were penning for their fathers in the dailies. Typically, Chip and his teammates faced obstacles that threatened their sense of teamwork and fair play. By the end, sportsmanship won out, good triumphed over evil, and virtue had been restored. The overwhelming theme of the Chip Hilton books was that to do good, one had to be good, and that the good teammate was the one who sublimated his own interest for the good of the team. If he were fictionalized, Mickey Mantle could have been Chip Hilton, given how he was typically portrayed. Jim thrived in Ridgewood. He professionalized his business cards, printing dozens of them in the school's print shop, and generating enough business doing whatever for whomever to ensure that he always had money in his pocket. Although he may have been so-so in the classroom, once the bell rang and after-school sports began, there was nobody better. In monochrome Ridgewood, where white families were comfortable and black ones mostly a rumor, a kid like Jim, who wanted it more than anyone else, who needed to win, couldn't help but succeed. He was an all-sports star in high school, excelling no matter what the sport, no matter what the season. He may not have been the biggest or the fastest, but nobody in Ridgewood High competed harder than Jim Boughton. Provided he never left its protective bubble, that would be enough. In 1954, after his freshman year at Ridgewood, the bubble burst. By that time, George had long since moved on from selling pressure cookers to become an operations manager at American Manganese. Offered an opportunity to run their plant in Indiana, George jumped and relocated the family just across the state line in Homewood, Illinois. That quickly, Ridgewood High was in Jim's rear-view mirror. Homewood itself was not all that different from Ridgewood, but it, along with many of the neighboring towns, lacked its own high school. Instead, it served as one tributary of many to sprawling Bloom Township High School, which took students from all of them. Located in Chicago Heights, one of the most industrial communities in the country after World War II, Bloom was everything Ridgewood High was not. It was large, it was diverse, and it could be brutal. Each town, monochromatic as it might have been, sent its young to Bloom, where everyone was stirred together. Chicago Heights would have been a culture shock on its own, replete as it was with factories, steel mills, and foundries, the prototypical lunch bucket community. Add in the multitude of races, classes, and ethnicities from the neighboring towns, and it became a salad bowl of American society. "This was not Ridgewood," Bob remembered. "Instead, this is where the real world is." It was an eye-opener in more ways than one. Bloom had nearly 4,000 students in all. When Jim arrived, he became little more than simply one of approximately 1,000 sophomores, more of a statistic than a star. "I had acne and braces, and I was miserable," he recalled years later. "Worse, no one knew I was a hero." He was hardly that. Bloom was a factory for athletes. Merely making a squad was an accomplishment. Forget about being the star. Just as he had in Ridgewood, he tried out for the varsity football and basketball teams. He was cut by both. In the spring, he tried out for the baseball team and barely managed to survive the final cut for the freshman and sophomore squad. Little matter, as he barely played anyway. He was warm-up Boughton, as he liked to describe himself years later, always in the bullpen, never in the game. Looking back, most notably in Ball 4, He always described this period with great humor, but at the time, the competitor in him seethed. His confidence with
sample complete. Ready to continue?